What would I do?
Yeah.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Insurance hearing today. We're going to start as a subcommittee. My vice chair has been detained in a meeting. We'll be down shortly. First item is Assembly Bill 387. Assemblymember McCarty. Thank you for joining us.
Committee of one, right?
Two, actually, but whatever works. Timeliness.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm hopefully presenting a straightforward bill here this afternoon, AB 387, which represents a negotiated settlement between the California Department of Insurance and the insurance industry regarding the approval process for disability insurance policies in California. Current law requires that prior to the issuance of disability insurance, the commissioner must review and approve such policies. However, a recent court case has created some confusion as to the timeline and what constitutes an actual approval. This bill clarifies the time frame of what is an approval. Secondly, the bill would require the commissioner to complete a study no later than January 2017, comparing California policy standards regarding disability insurance to other states. The bill has both support from the Department of Insurance and the insurance industry. With me today are representatives from the California Association of Health, Life, and Insurance Companies and the Department of Insurance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. Robert Harrell, Deputy Insurance Commissioner, representing the Department of Insurance. We're the sponsor of the measure, and as the author pointed out, this reflects a negotiated agreement between the department and ACLIC on policy approval matters. Three parts of the bill, two of which relate to the policy approval itself, one clarifying a timeline pursuant to the court case that is written up in the analysis and was mentioned by the author. The second, providing our ability to provide a little more assistance and guidance when we have companies asking about what they need to do. I literally just had a query last week on this very topic, so this is very timely for us to get this information out there on our website so that it can assist companies going through that process, work that out with ACLIC as well. Finally, on the study, the so-called compact, we have had some fruitful conversations with the compact itself, and we anticipate being able to go forward with that. And that would provide, we think, a very helpful comparison. California is not a member of the so-called compact. In some areas, it may reduce consumer protections. In other areas, the compact may have a better standard. So we think it's time for a thorough analysis there in the comparison. So with that, we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any witnesses in support?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, Ted Angelo with the Association of California Life and Health Insurance Companies. And I'd like to thank the author and the sponsors, the department, for working with us on these issues. We've been discussing product approval issues as well as this new issue that's part of this bill with the Elena decision that came down from the courts. We think the department, based on the determination of the courts, needs more time to be able to review policies based on what the court feels they are required to do. It's arguable. But what we will agree to do is work with them on that. That's what part of the bill does. The compact study is timely. It is good to see, as there's now 44 member states. California oftentimes has higher standards than what's put together in other states, but the national standards have come up, and so it would be good to take a look at what the differences are, as some have asked for uniformity in that area. We just want to take a look at what the differences are so we can compare and contrast. And lastly, we do think the department being able to have some forms and some requirements posted for companies to follow will help them with their workload and help expedite what has been a difficult area of policy approvals to get expedited. We think it'll help both parties, so we're in support. And sorry for taking so long to say that.
Oh, thank you. Any other witnesses in support? Witnesses in opposition? Colleagues, questions?
Yes.
go ahead. Moving
from 30 days to 120 days, would that delay the process before the insurance company or the insurance commissioner renders a decision of approval? I mean, because I see that you're moving it from 30 to 120 days. Hopefully, that is not to basically stall, but it's, in effect, going to help him move faster. I don't know, but it just seems like it's, you know, moving from 30 days, there's urgency. Moving it out to 120 days, it seems like you can take your time to get to it when you want to get to it.
Senator Hall, thank you very much for the question. It's, in fact, we think it will help expedite some of these reviews, and I'll tell you why. The way it works right now is that in some cases, because of backlog and numerous issues that may get raised with a particular approval that's pending, there has been the situation where the department has disapproved something within the 30 days to meet that criteria, then takes a longer look at it. We think that based on our negotiations with ACLIC and our looking at our workload, 120 days represents a much more realistic ability for us to really properly, thoroughly look at it so that we don't have to go through this temporary disapproval and then look at it later situation. So we think it actually will work to more fundamentally expedite the process and be able to deal with it in one fell swoop, which is more efficient.
Any other questions? It's been moved. Any public comment? Go ahead and establish a quorum first. Call the roll, please.
Roth.
Here.
Roth here. Gaines. Berryhill. Berryhill here. Glazer. Hall.
Here.
Hall here. Hernandez. Lou.
Here.
Lou here. Mitchell. Wachowski.
Here.
Wachowski here.
Bill has been moved. Let's take a vote on AB 387.
AB 387, do pass for appropriations. Roth.
Aye.
Roth, aye. Gaines. Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Glazer, Hall.
Aye.
Hall, aye. Hernandez, Lou.
Aye.
Lou, aye. Mitchell, Wachowski.
Aye.
Wachowski, aye.
Five
yes, 5 votes.
We have 5 votes. We'll hold the roll open for absent members. Thank you, sir. Let's see. Consent's been moved. Take a vote on the consent calendar. Consent calendar consists of items 3, 4, and 6. Assembly Bill 764, Assembly Bill 1131, and Assembly Bill 1515. Call the roll, please.
Roth.
Aye.
Roth, aye. Gaines. Berryhill. Berryhill, aye. Glazer. Hall. Hall, aye. Hernandez. Lou. Lou, aye. Mitchell. Wachowski.
Aye.
Wachowski, aye.
5 votes. We'll hold the roll open for absent members. Do we need we have an option? Somebody. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. We'll call item number 5, Assembly Bill 1232. Assemblymember Garcia. Welcome.
You're having too much fun, so I'll be quick. AB 1232 is the bill sponsored by Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones, aiming to increase government efficiency. New applicants for insurance agent or producer licenses sometimes have their applications closed after a background check by the Department of Insurance. An applicant may ask to have their case heard by an administrative law judge. The judge gives a proposed decision on the case that the insurance commissioner then upholds, denies, or modifies. The overwhelming majority of these cases are heard by the Office of Administrative Hearings in the Department of General Services. The Office of Administrative Hearings conducts hearings, mediations, and settlement conferences for more than 1,600 state, local, and county agencies. AB 1232 would allow the California Department of Insurance to use their own administrative law judges to hear appeal cases for new agents in order to streamline the hearing process. We took amendments which allow applicants to state their preference for whether the case is heard under General Services or the Department of Insurance. This bill would give licensed applicants more options and allow for savings in government money. Joining me to testify is Melissa Gear from the California Department of Insurance.
Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Melissa Gear, Deputy Legislative Director with the Department of Insurance. AB 1232 increases governmental efficiency by streamlining the licensee hearing adjudication process for new applicants by ensuring the department can more efficiently utilize its resources to protect consumers by allowing its administrative hearing bureau within the department to preside over new licensee applicant hearings. Existing law does not currently allow the department to hear a new licensee applicant cases. Currently, the hearings are heard by the administrative law judges with the Office of Administrative Hearings within the Department of General Services. A proposed decision is rendered, and the commissioner has the ability to modify, deny, or uphold the proposed decision. OAH conducts approximately 10,000 to 14,000 cases per year, which makes it challenging to schedule hearings for all outstanding applicants in a timely and expeditious manner. We believe that we could hear those cases in a more timely fashion. It is approximately 30 days that our ALJs within the Administrative Hearing Bureau would be able to hear those cases. Currently, we have about 370,000 licensed brokers, agents that the department licenses. We would only be talking about new applicants and this bill. So currently we send about 160 cases to the OAH. This bill would be 100 cases going to OAH under this proposed law. However, since the applicants now have the ability to choose between AHB within the department and OAH, that number may be reduced. I think that's it for me. So with that, I would just ask for an aye vote.
Been moved. Any other witnesses in support? Witnesses in opposition? Public comment? Questions, colleagues? Senator Mikowski.
Page 3 of our analysis, the fourth full paragraph, they're talking about the differences between the office OAH hearing and the CDI hearing. And something grabbed me where they said, you know, the defendant may present witnesses and therapists to say that, you know, I've got my abuse problem is conquered or handled. And then they say the CDI will present witnesses and documents supporting a conclusion that the applicant is unfit for the license, including witnesses or victims of a wrongful act. And that generally doesn't sound like a judicial sort of role as an administrative hearing. I see that on the other end when the office has held the hearing, they've given their recommendation, and then CDI says license, no license. But at that actual hearing, it sounds almost that somebody's requested a hearing, and this, you know, is a conclusion rather than a discovery, I guess. Can you comment on that?
So the attorneys within CDI, which are separate from the administrative law judges, they would be presenting their case. So they would be the ones that would be providing such evidence. And it's not that the ALJs are, they're independent. So they wouldn't know that until it's presented at the time of the hearing.
So that behavior would be the same in front of an OAH?
That's correct.
Also. Okay, then thank you for the clarification.
Maybe you addressed this, but I'm looking at length of time to resolve a case on page 5 of our analysis, and it talks about OAH claiming that it takes about 111 days from the date of a request to set to have the hearing. They claim that after receiving that, the hearing is normally within 2 weeks of the party's typical availability. That's when it's set. But then there's a sentence in here that says OAH explains that CDI attorneys often indicate they are unavailable for weeks or months. If, I don't know whether that's true or not, but if it is true or any portion of it is true, if the attorneys are not available, how is the time to have the hearing going to be dramatically reduced?
At the time that the request for a hearing from our department to OAH is submitted, they include dates of availability of the attorneys. And so with the hopes of being able to plan accordingly. So if OAH is planning a hearing when our attorneys are unavailable, that would need to be something that we'd have to discuss with them as to why they would be doing that, because they wouldn't have the parameters of when our attorneys would be available to move forward.
Oh, and I see. And CDI would have more control, theoretically, over the administrative hearing officers that are embedded in the department in terms of how they calendar hearings.
That's correct.
I see. Well, then one other question. Somewhere in the analysis, it talks about the fact that the AHB, ALJ, a lot of letters, ALJs, when they're not...
I'll go with the JD when I'm done with this bill.
When they're not conducting hearings or assigned other work, this isn't a budget committee, but what happens to that other work when the ALJs are hearing cases now that they didn't have to hear before?
Our ALJs hear all types of cases, some of them lasting for as many as a couple hours, some of them being a couple days, and some of them being as long as a couple of weeks to a month. So they're often preparing for cases. When they're not actually hearing cases, they're doing working on their proposed decisions and other such things related to their job duties. So these cases would be included and added into their schedule when time permits.
And your staffing is sufficient to handle?
Correct.
Thank you. Colleagues, any further questions? I think the bill's been moved. Let's call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Roth, aye. Gaines?
Aye.
Gaines, aye. Berryhill?
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Glazer?
Aye.
Glazer, aye. Hall?
Aye.
Hall, aye. Hernandez? Lou?
Aye.
Lou, aye. Mitchell? Wykoski? Wykoski, aye.
Six? Five? Seven? Seven votes sufficient for passage. We'll hold the roll open for absent members. Let's call item number two, Assembly Bill 447. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Good.
Thank you, sir. You may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Today, I'm presenting AB 447 regarding insurance discrimination for properties with Section 8 tenants. People with access to subsidized housing programs like the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program have been priced out of many of the rental markets by rising rents. Protecting the rental opportunities that remain affordable and accessible to low-income families is critical to preventing homelessness for this vulnerable population. AB 447 would make it illegal for an insurance provider to deny habitation insurance to a property owner or landlord on the basis that individual tenants of the property receive a voucher under the Section 8 or other low-income housing assistance program by making this group protected from discrimination under the California Insurance Code. It will not impact insurance for subsidized buildings or publicly funded buildings. It will impact only otherwise normal homes or apartment buildings with one or more tenants who receive housing vouchers. To be clear, I am not making the case that the risk which Section 8 tenants pose should be ignored, but rather I'm making the case that there is no inherent risk in a tenant who receives Section 8 vouchers. One important amendment I have taken provides clarification that there is no prohibition on any negative action resulting from factors other than those protected by this bill. If the building or home in question has any structural deficiencies, is in a high crime neighborhood, doesn't have smoke detectors, or any number of other currently allowed reasons, an insurance provider may choose to not review or fail to not renew or fail to approve a policy of insurance. The fact there may be a tenant who receives a housing subsidy in the building will not prohibit actions taken for other reasons. As a result of the amendments taken prior to this hearing, nearly all of the insurance providers have removed their opposition. I have several witnesses with me today in support, and thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and I respectfully request your aye vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. John Bowders, Policy Director at Housing California, a co-sponsor of this piece of legislation. And as the Assembly member properly noted, we have an affordability crisis here in California. We need to think outside the box at times about how we can help alleviate that problem. It doesn't always require construction of new housing. We have existing housing stock that could be made more accessible to people of lower and middle income means. This bill goes a long way to removing from the ambit of the insurance code an unsavory practice, which is to inquire as to the source of income or whether or not a tenant is receiving a subsidy. That puts the landlord or property owner in the situation where they have to determine whether or not to insure their property at times or whether or not to take a tenant who they would like to have living on the property. We think that's a false choice, and we think that property owners should be allowed to access insurance, that there's no actual basis, there's no evidence that illustrates a difference between whether or not a person receives a voucher or pays fair market rent from their own pocket. And for those reasons, we would ask for your aye vote.
Mr. Chair and members, Shanta Pekin on behalf of the California Apartment Association. Our members are in support. We believe that the housing voucher program plays an important role with regard to California's housing crisis and their availability of affordable housing. That being said, we encourage many of our members to actually participate in the voucher program, and many of them voluntarily do. But however, in order to ensure that there is adequate participation, our members have to be able to find the insurance and make sure it's at a reasonable rate. Without being able to find affordable and adequate insurance, they simply won't participate in the program. This bill goes a long way in order to ensure that cost-effective insurance is available, and we ask for your aye vote.
Good afternoon, members. Brian Augusta on behalf of the California Coalition for Rural Housing, one of the co-sponsors of the bill, and I'll just make one quick point in addition to the ones that have been made. The Housing Choice Voucher Program brings about $2.9 billion in federal assistance to California each year to help us meet our housing crisis in this state. We want to make sure that we remove any impediments to the participation of private landlords, like the members of CAA. This bill helps to do that by making absolutely clear that the presence of Section 8 voucher holders is not the basis for differential treatment of otherwise similarly situated buildings, and for that reason, we would urge an aye vote.
Anya Lawler, on behalf of Western Center on Law and Poverty, we are also a co-sponsor of this measure, and I'm happy to be here in support.
Thank you. Other witnesses in support?
Marina Wyant with the California Housing Consortium in support.
Any other witnesses in support? Witnesses in opposition?
Good afternoon. Sherry McHugh representing the Pacific Association of Domestic Insurance Companies. We want to thank the author and the sponsors for working with us. The recent amendments really solidified our neutrality, and we greatly appreciate the effort, and we are happy to be neutral on the bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Erin Norwood on behalf of Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Just want to echo the statements made by Ms. McHugh and appreciate the work that the authors and the committee and the sponsors. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Steve Suchel with the American Insurance Association, and we must oppose this bill because basically what it does is it removes, while there is a goal that's good, it removes basically an underwriting tool and precludes companies from getting adequate information with which to underwrite. What the bill does is it forces companies to accept building owners who have tenants with subsidized housing. This bill does not provide insurance to residents or to tenants. It's a building owner's bill. It helps building owners.
Can you explain that to me now? I know I understand what insurance does, but what I want you to explain to me is why is it not possible for the companies to go through an underwriting process where you evaluate the risk of a particular structure and set your premiums or make your underwriting decision on that basis, in other words, empirical data associated with a particular property? Now, maybe I may chair this committee, but I'm not an insurance expert, so maybe I'm missing something.
What the bill does is it says that a company cannot fail to provide insurance to an owner of a property that has subsidized tenants, so therefore it says you have to take that. The company has to take that. The second part of the bill says there's no information that can be gathered with respect to that, so that limits the ability to underwrite. And Senator, you are correct in that there are other factors that a carrier would look to underwrite. condition of the building, age of the building, other things. But what this does is it removes
claims,
location, and there's a whole number of things. What this bill does basically is it does present an impediment. A company may not want to write that kind of coverage. And I want to make a point here that there is coverage available. There is no lack of available coverage for subsidized housing. It's out there. I've done the research. I've seen the websites. I've seen the application forms. So the idea that somehow that there is a lack of availability or lack of coverage is not accurate. There is the coverage.
But if you inspected the property and you determined that it was in poor condition or that there were risks inherent with the design or the way the property is being maintained in view of the tenant population, you could set a premium accordingly. It might be high. I assume it might be high, it might be low, and take care of the and account for the risk associated with the building population, couldn't you?
Senator, that's correct, and that's what's done in let's say cases where there is not subsidized housing tenants on property. But what this bill does is it just removes the ability to underwrite that particular aspect. A company may not choose to write a certain kind of coverage, that there is risks involved, and a company may choose not to be involved with that risk. It's a business decision.
Okay.
And I like to emphasize there is the ability to underwrite, but there is no lack of availability of coverage. And I think that's one of the underlying premises behind this bill, is that somehow there is no coverage available, which is not the case.
Okay. I didn't mean to jump in the middle of the presentation. Sir, why don't we take your presentation, and then I'll let my colleagues ask questions. Can we? Absolutely.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, Theo Peos, representing the Association of California Insurance Companies. We agree, we don't see a problem. We don't think there's a lack of insurance for these kind of housing projects. So again, while we think the intent here is good, there's no other way to write it than the way it's written. And so what we would have to do in order to defend ourselves is to prove a negative, is that no, we did not write this policy, or we did not rate this policy because there are subsidized tenants involved. So you just make for a more obscure and a more complicated process in writing this stuff. If a particular company chooses not to write this type of risk at all, which we believe should be their prerogative, if they get an application, they decide not to write it, now they put themselves in harm's way because there's something that they have to prove a negative for.
Theoretically, if you had a balanced portfolio and you had some subsidized properties and some that weren't subsidized, if you turn one down, you can point to the fact that 15% of your portfolio is subsidized housing, so to defend yourself against the claim that you're discriminating against subsidized tenants. No, I have 100 properties that I have policies out on. I just chose not to do this one because it was high risk or whatever, or I set the premium accordingly.
Well, I agree with you, but now we have to go to that process of proving that, and there's a cost associated with that, and that's a cost that all insurers have to bear. So, again, California is a highly regulated market, and this just puts another bar yet that we have to reach in order to operate here. And again, while I agree with your analysis, some insurers may decide not to write this type of risk at all based on either the fact it's subsidized or based on the number of units, and now they put themselves in harm's way of this kind of analysis in case someone decides to file a lawsuit against them. So again, it's very difficult for the insurer. That's when they're trying to determine a number of risks, and we've just taken one away and we've put them in harm's way to have to prove a negative if we enact this bill.
I think, thank you. I think my vice chair, who knows more about insurance than I do, has a question.
I just would like a little clarification in terms of the criteria with the legislation. So I guess my question is, if there's a higher exposure for Section 8 housing, do you have the ability to price for it?
Under this bill, no.
And do you have evidence? I mean, is there evidence that there is higher claim activity? And that's my interpretation of what I'm hearing, is that there seems to be a higher incidence of claim activity for a Section 8 apartment building than there is for one that is not. And I'm just would like clarity as to whether
There may.
That is that the crux of the issue for your opposition?
A couple of reasons. One is there may or may there may not be increased claim activity with respect to subsidized housing. But on the other hand, underwriting subsidized housing is a specialized risk, and some companies choose to take it on and some don't. And what this bill says is a company can't refuse to do that. However, the chairman is correct. The companies can look to other criteria with which to underwrite. As you know, building condition, location, presence of a fire alarms, code, whatever is management of, as you know, senators, very often management of an entity is looked to when it's going to be underwritten for commercial purposes. And what we're talking about here is commercial properties. So while a Section 8, sorry, a subsidized a property with subsidized housing may or may not present risks, it is a specialized market, and the company may choose to undertake or not undertake that risk and also price the risk accordingly.
And Senator, okay, for the record, that section's been removed right here, and you're certainly welcome to look at it, but okay, the crossed-off section,
okay,
at the top.
And what section is that?
It was subsection A1 of the bill prior to the amendments we took.
Okay, but there was a section added. Yeah, sub D here. Nothing in this section prohibits an insurer from failing or refusing to accept an application for issuing or counseling or failing to renew a policy of insurance covered by this chapter as a result of underwriting or assessment of factors other than those characterized listed in subdivision A or as otherwise prohibited by law. So does that give you the ability to refuse without legal challenge or other challenges?
Senator,
there seems to be concern that if you don't quote a particular risk exposure, low-income housing, that you would then be at risk?
Senator, what the provision that was added does is clarify that a carrier can look to other risks. That wasn't made explicit in the bill at first, which is a good thing. But the second thing is, as Mr. Payos pointed out, is that if a carrier chooses to not underwrite a property for any number of risks, the concern is, as expressed by Mr. Payos, is also that it will be looked upon as a proxy for not wanting to underwrite or take on subsidized housing, which leads us to litigation. And that's a concern as well. But a carrier under this bill can look to other risks, clearly, which is good. But on the other hand, a carrier may not choose to want to enter in a particular market. And this says, the bill says, they have to offer the coverage. They can't deny based solely on subsidized housing.
Okay.
And I have to return to the fact that there is availability of subsidized housing, of coverage for owners of buildings with subsidized tenants.
Okay, so could the bill be amended to address your concern?
I'll let him answer first, I guess, but we've worked with this party for a long time. We've gotten every single other insurer, as you've seen here, in support. I really, with all due respect, I don't think there would be anything at this point that could be done. I mean, we'd certainly be willing to continue working. We have this whole time. But what I would say to get to the crux of it, this does not remove any underwriting tool. It doesn't remove anything. Anything about risk, lack of smoke alarms, high crime, the structure itself, the material of the roof, all those things that an insurance company takes into account, on how they're charging premiums, whether to insure or not, every single one of those factors can still be used. The only thing that can't be used is the fact that they can't ask on the application if it's a Section 8 tenant. And by the way, when we first started with this process, I said, if you have the ability to show us that Section 8 tenants are riskier, if they trash the place, if they light it on fire, if they do all those things, show us. You know, we would love to see that. If that's true, that would have changed whether we even proceeded with this. There's been no evidence by anybody that a Section 8 tenant in and of, with that fact, just the fact they're Section 8, is a riskier tenant. And we've asked for that if that was the case. So no one has ever provided that. That's the only difference in this from anything else. everything else on planet Earth that they were allowed to ask for, to look at in deciding the premium. All those things are still available. The one thing is just whether a Section 8 tenant, in and of it, that simple fact is a risk factor. That's it.
Okay.
And there's no private right of action, by the way, too.
Did I hear a response?
All right.
So. And then I'll be done. Just trying to get through the thought process.
As I've stated, Senator, it properties with subsidized tenants may or may not present more risk. But what the bill does is it makes an insurer underwrite the property, even if they choose not to enter that market. And I think that's the concern that I've expressed, is it says they have to write the coverage. And if you have a company with freestanding, they may not choose to write that. And I think, as I've stated before, it's a specialized business, and a company may choose to or choose not to enter that business, number one. And number two, I'm going to reiterate again, there is no lack of coverage available. It is out there.
All right. And I guess the author, if you see the marketplace where there are certain risks that aren't insured by an insurance company, is there a response or an effect as a result of that?
Well, I'm not totally sure I understand his point, necessarily what I'm responding
to. Would there be litigation? Would someone litigate?
I think what Mr. Wieckowski was going to ask, there is no private right of action. This doesn't create that. Mm-hmm. And again, all the risk factors, it doesn't change any of the risk factors they're allowed to use. The only thing is just the status of the tenant.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Gaines. Senator Wieckowski.
Currently, you can ask an applicant if they have Section 8 housing, so you can determine you don't want to underwrite this policy, and the insurer can do that. But under the bill, you can't ask that question, so how would you know? How would the insurance world know whether there was Section 8 housing there? It'd be tough to be discriminatory if you couldn't ask. Right, because now you're choosing. You're saying some of your clients don't want to provide this coverage, but they would never know. They would never know under this bill. You could never ask. Nobody would ever know about the wealth or the income stream that people have. How would that? It would just get into, as my colleague from Roseville said, it just sort of in that insurance pot, and the risk would be spread out.
Senator, I suppose that might be the case if it was a new applicant. But if this is a renewal, which, of course, a large portion of our book is, you would know, because that was information that was provided to you by other means. Mm-hmm. You could find out another way besides just on the application. Clearly, you might do a building inspection, so you might know by that method. So there are a number of ways in which you might know whether there is subsidized housing or not, regardless of whether or not it's on the application. Secondly, a private right of action has to do with a third party's ability to file a lawsuit. If you're a party to the contract and you claim that there's been some type of damage, you can still sue. There doesn't have to be a private right of action in the bill.
Yeah, no, it would be for the tenants to
correct. And again, this is not right, but this, as we've all acknowledged, this isn't about tenants. This is about building owners.
This does, Senator, the bill does not provide coverage to tenants. This intends to provide coverage to building owners who have tenants who are recipients of subsidized housing.
I'm going to forgive the author for that oversight in the bill.
Senator Hall.
Yeah, I'm trying to stomach what you're talking about right now. Because I am just downright offended by your assertion that poor people are specialized risk. I represent Watts, South Central, Compton, Wilmington, Harbor Gateway. My entire district represents the constituency that you're talking about. And how can you come up in this capital advocating for a company that's saying that specialized and poor people are specialized? And how can you expect me to stomach what you're talking about? You should be ashamed of yourself and your company for allowing you to come in here before this Senate panel and say, I quote, poor people or people with subsidized housing presents a specialized risk. That's my entire district. And if your company don't want to support or insure housing in my community, we don't want you there anyway. When you have all these other folks who have come up and said that they are in support of the bill. But your group said, and I quote, specialized housing presents a specialized risk. And I'm talking to you, and you refuse to look at me when I'm speaking to you.
Senator,
I'm talking. You've done yours.
Okay, Senator.
You've done your talking. I don't need to hear your comment right now. Because I'm trying to stomach your comments about my district. And it is my district. Because my entire district is filled with specialized housing and Section 8 housing. I don't live off the ocean front. I don't live in the hills of Beverly Hills. I don't live in the Palisades. I live in Compton, Watts, Willowbrook, South Los Angeles, and Wilmington, where we are laced with specialized housing of people who are smart, who are trying to lift themselves up by the bootstraps and make something out of themselves. And I'm trying to figure, go to work every single day, trying to raise children, and yet they're deemed a specialized risk. And I'm not asking for a comment, and Mr. Chair, this is just a statement, not a question. You should be ashamed of yourself for coming into this Capitol advocating and for a company or a group or an organization saying that people who receive Section 8 or specialized housing are a specialized risk. My mother raised 6 kids, and we were on welfare on a 2-bedroom house in Compton. And how dare you come in this building and utter such words, discriminatory as they are. And I'm not asking for a response, nor do I want one.
Any public comment? Bill has been moved. Please call the roll.
Roth?
Aye.
Roth, aye. Gaines?
No.
Gaines, no. Berryhill? Glazer? Glazer, aye. Hall?
Aye.
Hall, aye. Hernandez? Lou?
Aye.
Lou, aye. Mitchell? Wachowski?
Aye.
Wachowski, aye.
Five to one. Sufficient to get out. We'll hold the roll open for absent members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
She's at. This concludes our agenda. We're going to hold the roll open for absent members. Thank you all for attending. Yeah. Colleagues, we're going to start at the top and.
Did you get the first?
Yeah. We're going to call the bills. So if you were here a little late, we're going to pick you up.
AB 387, due pass to appropriations, the chair voting aye, calling absent members. Glazer?
Aye.
Glazer, aye. Hernandez? Okay. That has 7 votes, sir. 7 votes.
7 votes. We'll hold the roll open.
AB 447, due pass to the floor, chair voted aye, calling absent members. Hernandez, Mitchell? Consent calendar? Yeah, sir.
Did Steve get the consent calendar? She got the consent calendar.
Glazer. I'm sorry, Chair.
Yeah.
387. Gaines.
Senator Glazer?
Aye.
Yes.
Senator Glazer?
Are you on the consent? Did you get the consent calendar?
No, he didn't. That's what I was about to get. I got you on.
Okay.
The consent calendar, items 3, 4, and 6, I believe. Gaines?
Aye.
Gaines, aye. Glazer?
Aye.
Glazer, aye. Hernandez? Mitchell. Okay. Okay. AB 1232, calling the absent members, Hernandez, Mitchell. And that's it. That's it for now. Ready?
Starting at the top.
AB 387, due pass to appropriations. Chair voted aye. Calling absent member Hernandez. Hernandez, aye. It has 8 votes.
8 votes.
Item number 2, AB 447, due pass to the floor. Chair voted aye. Calling absent member Hernandez. Aye. Hernandez, aye. 6-1.
6-1. Bill is out.
And the consent calendar, AB 764, calling absent member Hernandez. Aye. Hernandez, aye.
Consent calendar's out.
AB 1232, due pass to appropriations. Chair voted aye. Hernandez. Aye. Hernandez, aye. That's 8 votes, and that's all.
8-0, matter's out. That's it. Thank you very much.